Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is the Tuesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, it's called COVID brain fog.
But the main hallmark feature of brain fog is really the disruption of attention and everything that goes along with that.
I'll speak with neuropsychologist Dr. Faith Gunning. She's involved with testing a prescription video game to curb the condition. All that's just ahead. But first this, there will be no price gouging at Georgia's gas pumps. Today, Governor Brian Kemp signed an executive order temporarily suspending the gas tax in Georgia. Now that's because of the Colonial Pipeline cyber attack. And Kemp's executive order further prohibits, quote, price gouging by bad actors looking to exploit the situation. In addition, Kemp's executive order states that Georgia is increasing the weight limits for those trucks that are transporting fuel, which will provide more supply for stations as they receive their deliveries. Colonial Pipeline is headquartered in Alpharetta, Georgia, and transports a large amount of gasoline from Texas to the Northeast. In a statement, executives with Colonial Pipeline say they're working to, quote, substantially restoring operational service by the weekend. Meanwhile, analysts are telling consumers not to panic, but in North Carolina, there are already long lines at gas stations, and a Closer Look listener says he's had to drive around the city to find gas. By the way, let us know if you're having trouble as well, or tell us where there's plenty. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. And Governor Kemp signed into law yesterday an overhaul of the state's citizen arrest statute. Prior to the signing, Georgia's citizen arrest law was considered vague. Now that law no longer exists, and it limits Georgians as to who can arrest folks believed to have committed a crime.
Today we are replacing a Civil War era law right for abuse with language that balances the sacred right to self-defense of a person and property with our shared responsibility to root out injustice and set our state on a better path forward.
The bill signing comes as there are state and now federal charges against three white men involved in Ahmaud Arbery shooting death in February of last year. Greg and Travis McMichael and their neighbor William Roddy Bryan claimed they were making a citizen's arrest and believed Arbery was responsible for some previous break-ins. A federal arraignment on hate crimes and attempted kidnapping charges is set for today, and hearings in the state murder prosecutions are scheduled for tomorrow and Thursday. Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, and his sister also attended the signing. In other news, Georgia's COVID-19 vaccination rate could be increasing soon. Now that the FDA is authorizing Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for use in kids ages 12 to 15, right now, Georgia's vaccination rate is still stuck at 28% of those eligible to receive the vaccine. And according to the state health department, more than 6.5 million vaccine doses have been administered. This is Closer Look. And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. You may recall on this program, I had a conversation with Dr. Jermaine Jackson. Now, he's an Atlanta-based pulmonologist about the acute and chronic stages of COVID-19. Shortly after the Piedmont Pulmonary COVID-19 Recovery Clinic opened, Dr. Jackson shared that 80% of people infected with the coronavirus are asymptomatic. Dr. Jackson also shared that people usually recover from the virus between 8 to 10 days, but in some cases could take up to 4 weeks. And in some cases, people suffer from what's called long COVID or long-haul symptoms.
Fortunately, we're starting to see a decline in the number of cases as well as in the number of deaths that are occurring. but we still got a long way to go as we continue to learn more and more about this disease, both its acute or early impact, as well as the long-term effects of the coronavirus.
And now we know that one of those long-term effects is referred to as COVID brain fog. So what exactly is COVID brain fog? Well, that's why our next guest is here. Joining me now is Dr. Faith Gunning, a neuropsychologist and the vice chair of research in the Department of Psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medicine, located in New York. Dr. Gunning, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Dr. Gunning, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Gunning, we'll get into your research in just a moment, but first, I'd just like to get your personal thoughts on the FDA's authorization of the new Pfizer vaccine for children ages 12 to 15. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's remarkable progress that's been made, that we're now able to extend that vaccine down to children and adolescents. I think it's going to be a game changer going forward as far as school and getting our kids back and integrated into their regular lives.
And I'm curious, as a scientist yourself, what has captivated you about this coronavirus? We've been dealing with this now for over a year.
So I think as a scientist, the variability in how people respond to the illness and how it presents and the symptoms and the level of severity is really striking. And I think many would agree with that, that it's just striking how variable it is and somewhat unpredictable. And then I think as we progress and time passes, what has been striking and concerning is the number of people who are presenting with ongoing symptoms after the acute recovery phase.
And that's where we get into your research. But I want to define some terms for our listeners that they'll hear during this conversation. So first, let's begin with just defining. We've talked about this a little bit before on our program, but for those who may be hearing this for the first time, let's define what we mean by a COVID long hauler.
So a COVID long hauler is somebody who continues to experience symptoms after the acute period of illness. So typically that's defined as following 4 to 6 weeks after they've recovered from the illness.
And while it's not technically a scientific or medical term, let's explain for our listeners what COVID brain fog is and the symptoms that come with that.
So COVID brain fog is a bit of a catch-all term. And what it typically refers to is difficulty concentrating and attending to what's happening in one's daily life. So people will describe it as feeling different, that their thinking is different or a little bit off. But the main hallmark feature of brain fog is really the disruption of attention and everything that goes along with that.
So it's a cognitive condition, or am I totally off here?
You know, people do define it. Some people define it more broadly. I may be biased as a neuropsychologist. I really define it as a cognitive symptom. There are other symptoms that may go along with it, but the brain fog is typically thought of as a cognitive disturbance or difficulty.
And so far, do we know, does it tend to affect a specific patient population, male, female? Have you all been able to identify if it's broken down, if it's more prevalent based on ethnicity or race? What do we know
about? So I hate to give this answer, but I think we're still fairly early in understanding this COVID brain fog. And so we don't know yet. It does appear to occur more frequently in individuals who had more severe COVID illness, but it is still appearing in a significant subset of individuals who had more mild illness. So we're still trying to understand that. And I think that's going to be really important to understand as we think about how we're going to manage it.
And how long after recovery have patients talked about this COVID brain fog, these symptoms appearing?
So there's not as much scientific data about this just because of the course of when COVID presented and how long we've been studying it. But there are reports of it persisting in some individuals, in a subset of individuals, several months following the illness. That's where it becomes particularly concerning, because if it's for a truncated period of time and then goes away, then it's disturbing, but it's less concerning. It's for the individuals when it's several months after we would have thought they would have recovered from the illness.
Does it appear that this COVID brain fog, it gets better, or is still too early? Or
I think it's too early to know. My hypothesis is that for many individuals, it will get better over time. And I think that typically with any illness involving that impacts the brain, there is a period of recovery. From what we understand, in a subset of individuals, it will get better over time, and they may very well return to their pre-COVID levels of functioning. And then a smaller subset may experience more persistent symptoms. I'm a little hesitant to say too much about the course of it yet, because sure. I think we don't understand that well yet.
I'm curious, prior to the pandemic, can you think of, or was there any other condition that might have mirrored COVID brain fog?
People have talked about like brain fog within the context of some other illnesses. So for example, with post-concussion, so people who have suffered from concussions, they've also talked about it within the context of cancer survivors, the most common being breast cancer survivors, a subset. And also following an ICU stay, this brain fog, it's not unheard of. With COVID, one of the things that's very concerning is the sheer number of people who have been infected with it. And then thinking, even if it's a small subset who experience this brain fog, the numbers are substantial.
The voice you hear is Dr. Faith Gunning, a neuropsychologist and the vice chair of research in the Department of Psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medicine up in New York. And we're talking about COVID brain fog, what is it, and her research in testing a new interactive way of helping folks that are experiencing COVID brain fog. So let's discuss this trial that you're conducting at Weill Cornell Medicine. And I know when we hear video games, and I love video games, but this is not necessarily new. This is in using this interactive therapeutic game, Endeavor RX. I'll let you take it from here. Mm-hmm. Before we get into how you hope it will help with COVID brain fog, you've had experience with this type of, should we call it a therapy or a treatment?
I like to call it an intervention, because for COVID brain fog, we think it will work, but we don't have the data yet to say that it will. So I primarily do research, but in the clinical aspect of my work, where in seeing patients, I have worked in rehabilitation medicine for many years. I started working with an earlier version of what is now Endeavor RX several years ago with some of my colleagues. And we actually first tested it out in older adults who were suffering from depression. Mm-hmm. And the reason we tested it out, and I didn't think it was going to work, but the reason we tested it out is because in this subset of older adults with depression, they had both mood symptoms, but they also had cognitive symptoms. So they had difficulty with attention and was fairly disabling, and tended not to respond well to standard approaches to treating depression. Mm-hmm. So we actually used this video game in a clinical trial and compared it to the gold standard psychotherapy. And in that initial small trial, what we found was that both groups, their depression improved to the same degree, which is interesting, because the individuals were doing the video game at home with just weekly check-ins to make sure they were safe and they were doing the game. So it was quite impressive, but only the group who participated in the video game condition actually showed improvement in their what we call working memory, or the ability to hold mm-hmm. information online and manipulate it. And we actually did brain MRIs pre and post the use of the video game, and we showed improvement in the connections among some of the brain areas that we think are very important in both depression and to support attention and multitasking and a lot of these cognitive skills we use in our daily life. And then the Achille Interactive, whose platform it is, they've also tested it in other neurologic groups and have very positive results.
So at what point did it hit you or the other researchers, or you particularly, you said, you know what, well, maybe this will work with those experiencing this COVID brain fog?
So in the fall, we have data collected from individuals who were treated in the hospital and specifically on a rehabilitation medicine unit. And we had data to show that in a very high proportion of those individuals, they were showing this difficulties with attention and multitasking, similar difficulties that the video game targets, EndeavorRx targets. And so we had this observation. I've been working with the folks at Achille for a while, and they had recently gotten FDA clearance for their intervention for ADHD. And really being in New York, or probably wherever you were in the country at the time, you know, and seeing the sheer prevalence of number of people being infected, and that there were these cognitive issues that were appearing. I think we simultaneously in around October or November came to the idea that it would be really great. We're going to have to figure out how we can intervene mm-hmm. with the sheer number of people who may end up with some persisting cognitive issues. And that's the great thing about EndeavorRx is it can be done at home.
And I wonder if you can, if we can, I wish we were doing video, we could maybe play a clip of it. This video game, what is the goal or, you know, when I think of video games, I grew up on Pac-Man and Astro.
Yeah, Wars. Me too.
I'm showing my age and Donkey Kong. What's the mission in the video game?
So the focus of it really is to target multitasking. So the ability to do more than one thing at a time. And so the way it looks like a video game, one task is to steer the iPad mm-hmm. in order to avoid some of the obstacles and to stay on the path that you're supposed to be on. And at the same time, respond to certain types of stimuli that are coming your way and ignore others. So it's really a multitasking type of intervention, and it's beautiful. The graphics are beautiful. So the other reason that I find it an interesting intervention is that because it's fun and, you know, it has points and badges and you level up, and because the way the algorithm works, and I won't go into detail about this, but it's individually adapted for whoever's doing it. So it's not like it all of a sudden it becomes way too hard or way too easy. So it keeps the individual engaged.
And what does that do for the brain? Does it provide some type of stimuli, or what is it doing to the brain?
So the way I think about it, when the video game is done in an ideal way, it's an almost daily basis for about 25 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. And so basically it's repeated engagement of what I think of is these networks that are likely brain networks are not functioning as efficiently as they could be. Mm-hmm. And so with this repeated engagement, what we believe is that it actually improves the functioning of those networks and the connection among those networks. The multitasking, when you think about daily life, and I think about my daily life, the ability, when you improve the brain networks that support that kind of function, multitasking is important for everything we do. So we might think of it as memory, but if you can't pay attention to more than one thing at a time, you're going to not take in a lot of information that might be necessary for work or even going to the grocery store or for social interactions.
Are you all currently enrolling participants in this trial?
Yes, it's a trial. We're right on the launching pad. We're about ready to start. We just have to get through certain regulatory aspects, but we're very, very close.
And how long could it take to determine whether or not the game, this intervention is become effective? How do you measure that?
Individuals who enroll will do the game for 6 weeks. We'll look at both their cognitive abilities and also their functional abilities, their ability to function in daily life, both before and after the 6 weeks of the intervention. Our goal is to enroll quickly, and it's a fully remote study, so it can be done in people's homes, and we'll provide the technology that they need. We wanted to cast as wide a net as possible and not only enroll people who could come in through the institution. So we're hoping that we will finish the actual trial within 6 months. We want to get results out there at a time when it can be maximally beneficial if it works, to the greatest number of people.
Meanwhile, what has been working for those experiencing COVID brain fog? Has there been anything that works?
So people are trying. Some of the standard rehabilitation methods would work, where teach people strategies and coaching and how to compensate for their difficulties. And that is tried and true approach to rehabilitation of cognitive issues. I think that the reason something like this is interesting to us is that we can reach more people. Not everybody is going to get in to see a highly trained rehab specialist. Yeah. So we may, if this works, then it can reach a broader range of people, and they may use it alone or they may use it in combination.
Dr. Faith Gunning, a neuropsychologist and the vice chair of research in the Department of Psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medicine, located in New York City. Dr. Gunning, it's a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time. We want to check back in with you all along the way and how this is going.
That would be great. Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org. Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. Raise your hand if you need a vacation. Not you driving. In fact, some of our Closer Look listeners told me, yes, they need a vacation, and their summer plans include traveling.
Both my wife and I have gotten our shots, and so we're going to travel. Of course, we're going to practice social distancing and everything. So we're going to be in the car, and we're going to enjoy the economy opening back up, and we want to contribute to it. We're going to save up and enjoy what Florida has to offer.
We're going now to Florida. We're driving, but this summer we're hoping to go out of the country to the Caribbean, if that's possible. But we've been trying to get the vaccine. We haven't been able to get both vaccines yet, but we certainly would love to get the vaccines before we travel.
You know, next month I plan on going back to Michigan to see some family. Really want to see my parents and my uncles and my grandparents, and everyone got vaccinated, and I'll be fully vaccinated. Me and some friends decided that we're going to head to Mexico and kind of just enjoy and get away.
Y'all going to Florida? Mexico? All right, cool. According to a new report from TripAdvisor, more than 67% of Americans plan to travel this summer. And, of course, Memorial Day is just weeks away. The report finds that hotel and lodging searches are on the rise as well. And now that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they have these latest guidelines, easing up those masking restrictions for fully vaccinated people, y'all are going to be all over the place, which means this summer will look nothing like last,
meaning a very busy summer. And that includes short-term rental companies such as Airbnb, which they've launched an 8-point plan called the Summer of Responsible Travel. And joining me now to talk more about this is Ben Bright from Airbnb's Public Affairs Department. Ben, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
What are you doing this summer? Are you traveling? Where are you going?
I'm traveling all over the place and making up for all the weddings that were postponed that I was supposed to be at last year. So should be busy and should be on the road quite a bit.
So when y'all hear folks are going to hit the road, they're traveling this summer, that is good for folks like you and your industry. How long you been in this space?
So Airbnb was founded actually in the midst of the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. So just as President Obama was taking office, kind of a weird time to be starting a company. But that's the origin story of Airbnb. It was founded in San Francisco. Just a few our co-founders were just trying to make their rent. Yeah, by renting out a few airbeds on their floor, literally. Mm-hmm. during a conference that came to town. And all these years later, we've got 5.6 million listings throughout the globe, including quite a few in Atlanta.
You know, you all did report a revenue of $859 million for the fourth quarter of last year, but you did cite a loss. I imagine did the pandemic have a little bit to do with that?
Yeah, you know, a year ago at this time, It was a scary. It was obviously a scary moment for everyone, for obvious reasons. But you know, for those of us at the company, for our host community, you know, travel literally stopped. Mm-hmm. It paused, and it was just unclear. You know, what is this going to look like moving forward? But as we began to learn more about this virus and how it spreads, and that there are ways to leave your home safely and responsibly if you're following that public health guidance, you know, we started to see things pick up. People who wanted to get out of their homes but wanted to be able to socially distance too. You know, and when the CDC came out and said, look, if you're going to travel, you know, the safest way to do so appears to be in a vacation rental. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much in, you know, a giant hotel with a huge lobby and you're sharing elevators, right? So we started to see a spike in people who wanted to get out of their homes, were able to do it safely and responsibly. We saw spikes in rural travel. So people, I mean, Atlanta is always an incredible destination. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people wanted to get off the beaten path, even out of cities. So there have been some really fascinating trends as a result.
So are you saying if folks wanted to maybe check out more remote destinations?
Yeah, that's where there's just a ton of growth going on. And I think we're going to continue to see that, even though there's now a light at the end of the tunnel, people are getting vaccinated. So that should hopefully be, you know, positive for, you know, more urban, you know, big cities that have always been great destinations, such as Atlanta, of course. But I think, you know, the trend of kind of rural staycations, that's not going away. Mm-hmm. I think people have fallen in love with a lot of these communities, especially out near lakes, out in the mountains, really skyrocketed in popularity.
That being the case, Ben, you have to give guidelines. Obviously, we know about the public health officials, but you also have to give guidelines to your host. And now you have this new 8-point plan, the Summer of Responsible Travel. How did all this come about?
Sure. So, you know, it started in the wake of the pandemic where, you know, we were trying to get guidance out to our hosts and to our guests on what is the way to be able to travel responsibly. And of course, this is before the vaccine was widely available. So at the time, we actually brought aboard Dr. Vivek Murthy, who is now the Surgeon General. Mm-hmm. He was not at the time. This was prior to the election. So he was able to, you know, help us with that guidance. And I think most importantly, a pretty comprehensive cleaning protocol that we were asking, in particular, our hosts to adapt to and to follow. And to their credit, you know, they really stepped up. I think cleaning, you know, for anyone who's used Airbnb or short-term rentals before, and particularly for those who have hosted, cleaning has always been paramount. I mean, mm-hmm. if you're not doing the job on the cleaning front, even in normal times, you're not going to last very long. And our platform really is the reality. But obviously, you know, everyone had to raise their game, and there were kind of particular measures that that we were recommending and eventually began to mandate that they follow. And one unique one is just asking, hey, you know, if you're going to be coming into contact with your guests for whatever reason, you need to be wearing a mask. Just really simple stuff like that. and just following the public health guidance. So some of this kind of predates the vaccine being widely available, but as things are opening up, travel is coming back. People are getting, hopefully immune from this horrific violence that is, just ravaged our entire country, including Atlanta. We still need to be following that public health guidance.
Do you have a mask for your dog, Ben?
Yeah. I may run back and take care of that.
Your dog's fine. It's okay. It's public radio.
She's so excited about safe and responsible travel.
It's public radio. We don't care about dog barking. Let me ask you this, because we're talking about safety measures with Ben Bright. He's a public affairs with Airbnb, because it goes beyond, obviously, when we're talking about the coronavirus. But you all have had another issue here. And in this new plan, I understand you have something that you can hopefully prevent so-called party houses. Now, here in Atlanta, right, we've had city council members raise concerns over this. Totally. What do you all have in this 8-point plan that addresses that?
Sure. So some of this is long term and some of this is really special for the upcoming summer. We know that this is an issue of concern, particularly in Atlanta. In many ways, predates Airbnb. But look, the reality is when bars closed, when clubs closed, or at least were restricted, some of that behavior, people didn't want to stop it. Mm-hmm. And they attempted to take it to homes that they were renting. So we really had to step up. It's just not something we're going to tolerate. We banned parties. We banned party houses, right? So with that, we're talking about a home where, it's happening over and over and over again. We're getting reports every weekend. That's not something we're going to tolerate, but also just straight up parties in general, messaging out to our guests. Look, if that's something you're trying to do, first off, maybe don't. Maybe follow, the advice of the public health officials, of the Atlanta officials, and don't do that. But also, there's going to be really stringent measures that we're going to take. We've even begun, in certain cases, taking legal action against guests, who've thrown unauthorized parties, mm-hmm, who have violated both our rules, our host rules, for the duration of much of the pandemic, the city's rules. Right. So just not something we're going to tolerate.
So, Ben, how do you define party and then a gathering? And then also, I'll let you finish that. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's good because, we've also set an occupancy cap at 16 people. Obviously, a party or something disruptive can still happen with less than 16 people. We acknowledge that. So drawing the line at 16 has helped get some clarity out to our hosts and guests that I don't care what you're doing. If it's over 16 people right now in this pandemic, not okay. And below that, look, it's just about respecting neighbors and just nothing disruptive is really the name of the game. So another thing we've rolled out is a 24/7 neighborhood hotline. Mm-hmm. It's accessible at airbnb.com/neighbors. And we encourage any neighbors to follow up with us if there's anything we need to know about.
How do you make sure that folks aren't going to be unfairly profiled as well in terms of the guests?
100%. And this is something, you may already be aware of this, but dating back to 2016, this first came, became public, I think, in a really big way. The Airbnb While Black hashtag, mm-hmm, and it was a real formative moment for the company. So a few things that we've done in the wake of that were a beefed up non-discrimination policy. We've introduced a community commitment in addition to that. So it's on the front end. As you're joining the platform, we're asking you to commit that basically you won't be racist. it's a little less blunt than that. But
yeah, you're assuming folks will say, I commit to not, being someone who's racist.
But interesting is there are over 1.4 million people who have declined that community commitment because they couldn't accept that commitment we were asking them to align with, just saying that
really?
They could not act without absolutely over.
Well, I guess that's good. You want to know who doesn't want to commit to being a racist.
100%. And those people are banned from Airbnb. And honestly,
that
good
is
reasons,
wild.
Right?
Yeah, and that's maybe not surprising, Ben.
Totally. So I think there's a lot more. One thing that we've done as well is we have taken away profile photos until the booking is accepted, right? So this is something that we were hearing from guests saying, look, when I'm trying to get a reservation, my photo is evident and I feel like it may be a factor, right? So we took that away. So hosts are not seeing that profile photo until after the booking, mm-hmm, is already accepted. I think there's a lot more on the way and we got a lot more work to do, but I think we're proud of what we've accomplished so far in the wake of of that real formative moment in 2016.
Ben, as we wrap up, what have you all learned in terms of how the pandemic might change your industry, or, you know, home sharing or home, you know, short-term rental industry as a whole? What were lessons learned here?
100%. I think what we've learned is travel is never going to be the same. And additionally, talking about some of these rural destinations, that trend is not going away. I mean, I think people have fallen in love with a lot of these areas of the country that haven't traditionally been huge travel hubs. So that's number one. But also the way work is changing, where you're going to see a lot more flexibility, a lot more people able to work remotely. We're seeing a lot more folks who are just kind of booking Airbnbs for a month or two and just kind of living elsewhere, living and working. Mm-hmm. I did it myself along with my wife for 2 weeks back in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and we loved it. So I think that's a trend that's not going away as well.
All right. Ben Bright with Airbnb's Public Affairs Department. We'll have a link to your 8-point plan for the summer of responsible travel. Ben, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it. What's your dog's name?
Her name is Bree.
Bree? All right. Yeah. Fairly behaved. We'll go with that.
So what? Yeah. A little bit of hiccup, but we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben, for taking the time. I appreciate it. Yes, it's that time of year. Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. I know, get your Kleenex out, get your cameras out, camera phones. Graduations from pre-K to college. Yes, they have pre-K graduations. I should know because I've been to one. It was over in like 5 minutes, but nevertheless, he graduated. For the past few years on this program, I've spoken to a lot of area graduates about their journeys and hopes for the future. Last year, we had to take a brief pause due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but now we're back and ready to hear more great stories from the class of 2021. Joining me now to kick off this series, he's the first one up. It's Andre Lugwit, a chemistry student from Clayton State University. Andre, thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, Rose.
How are you? How's this last year been for you?
It's been unlike anything I've ever experienced. Having to adapt my learning style to online learning, it's been a trip for everybody, I'd have to say.
How did you adapt? How'd you get through it?
I had to double down on everything I knew about networking and using computers for everything from textbooks and communicating with my professors and learning to do pretty technical stuff, including a little bit of computer coding, which was, I think, very helpful for the future.
And as a chemistry student, you're used to being in the lab and doing all that. I guess that'd be a little shock to your system as well, right?
Yeah, being in the lab is, I think, the bread and butter of being a chemist. You get to experience firsthand the chemical changes that you're making, and a lot of the systems. It's, I think, difficult to do that kind of research at home when you're away from the lab. So we had to make do and institute some more policies where we'd take turns, shifts in the lab using equipment, and everybody came together pretty well to overcome those odds and keep this learning on track.
Let's go back a little bit to your roots. You grew up in South Georgia, right?
Little Waycross, Georgia, yeah, Ware County, 912 crew.
Now you're down. Is that in the old Okefenokee area?
Oh, yeah. I'm a swamp kid.
Now, see, I would never call you that, because you can call yourself that, but I would never call you that, swamp kid. Get out of here. What was it like?
Term of endearment. It's pretty rural. It's pretty country. Living in Atlanta now for a little over a decade, it's a night and day as far as the way things usually take place. There's a lot more people-oriented stuff to do up here, and down there, there's way more nature to look at and experience.
Well, and let's be clear, Andre, we don't have to worry about gators coming up, you know, in the morning on your porch. At least not where I live.
Right. No, you don't really have to worry about the gators going up on your porch unless you got little pooches on the porches.
Tell me about your childhood, because I understand a lot of that in terms of what your parents were into, your father. A lot of that has shaped kind of your interest in what you want to do.
Oh, definitely. My father really instilled in me an intellectual desire, curiosity to want to learn more and try to see things from new perspectives. My father's from Colombia as well, so I grew up with an international perspective in an area that's pretty socially homogenous. It's not as much diversity in rural Georgia and South Georgia. So my father definitely helped shape a lot of the way that I perceive things, and particularly the way that I like to care for the environment. My mother definitely instilled a pretty gracious heart in me as well. So between my mother, my father, and my sister, Michelle, I think I turned out okay.
Let's talk about your passion for the environment. And what exactly did your father do?
He's a soil conservationist. He works for the NRCS, which is a part of the USDA. He goes around and maps soils all around the South.
When you assess, and this is through your personal lens, when you assess how we, and we'll just say as a nation, we won't pick on Georgia, but as a nation, and we've come a long way in terms of, you know, sustainability and obviously concerns about the environment. How would you assess how we as a nation, how we're doing now in terms of efforts to really get people, everyone on board in terms of understanding the importance of protecting our environment?
There's far more awareness now, and I can see it starting to grow even more here in Atlanta, in the Atlanta area. But I think sustainability as a public opinion is still in its infancy, and we're still learning a lot about some of the negative effects of our like plastic consumption, of our different like air pollution. We're still seeing some of the effects creeping up on us, and it's not well known yet. And I think if I had to give a class grade, I would give us about a B, B plus as far as how well we're educating the general populace as to how things are being polluted. But I think there's still, for instance, looking out on the roads, you see a lot of trash and little plastics. And I know some people say, well, it's just like a little gum wrapper. Well, it's the little things that are hard to collect on down the road. And eventually they make their ways down to the ocean. And it's easier to net larger things, but the microplastics might be causing some deleterious effects on our health in the long term.
Well, we've all seen, you know, video footage of the garbage, trash, whatever you want to call it, plastic that is just floating and out there in some of our waterways. Why do you think it's still such a hard message to get across to some people? Or not just to people, because we want to be fair, because a lot of our products that we buy, that we purchase, everything that we bring into our homes, that comes from manufacturers. So why do you think it's still such a hard sell, I guess, for folks to understand? And maybe people say, well, if you give me an alternative to my grocery shopping plastic bag, then I'll take it. What's your response to that?
So I think a great way to sum it up is out of sight, out of mind. A lot of people don't know where the garbage ends up and how it collects in huge piles in different places of the earth. Because it's out of sight and out of mind, it's not something that people think about whenever they're in the aisles, like, oh, what's going to happen to this bottle of water or something. Once you finish the water that's inside, is there a way to reuse this plastic? And thankfully, we've been pushing hard for recycling plastics and moving away from plastic, maybe something that's easier to recycle like glass. Mm-hmm. But it's still an uphill battle because it's so cheap to build something out of fresh plastic. Mm-hmm. The economic incentive isn't quite there yet.
If you just join us, I'm joined by Andre Lugwit. He's a chemistry student from Clayton State University. He kicks off our Closer Looks annual graduate series profile. And, you know, this is you're getting a degree in chemistry, but this is also a second degree for you, correct?
Yes.
You just love school, degree. Don't you, Andre?
I really do. Going back to school when you're older, it's you already have a good idea of who you are. So you're not doing the dual learning technical stuff and then also learning who you are outside of your home. So going back to school is way more fun as you're older and you're better aware of how you best learn. So I really enjoy school. My first degree was at Georgia State mm-hmm. University in political science. That goes back to my father being an intellectual and putting that in me. I just enjoy learning. It doesn't really matter what. I like the details.
I understand. I hear you. In other words, there's hope for me to get a PhD is what you're saying.
That's the goal. I made a deal with my wife that I go ahead and get into business and make some money before I go back to grad school. But eventually I'll get there.
Speaking of the future, what do you want to do? How do you want to wrap all of what you have achieved so far, and then also with this passion you have for the environment, what do you want to do?
So the way I see things going, I believe with our new computational prowess, I believe that a lot more chemistry is going to be able to be simulated on computers. So if I go back for my PhD, I want to do something where I can use computers to simulate these chemical reactions. It'll decrease our need for reagents, which is very costly to purchase, but also very costly to have in store, mm-hmm. and also very costly to dispose of. So by being able to use just a computer to simulate physical interactions between the chemicals, I think that is like the way that chemistry will eventually go.
Using chemistry and sustainability for the environment.
And especially there. Understanding the way that things interact at the chemical level mm-hmm. helps you paint a better macroscopic picture.
And let me ask you this before I let you go. How optimistic are you that we'll get to some point in this, in your lifetime, that we will? And what is, a proper metric to assess when this nation has achieved this plateau of really being truly a nation that has taken all of these green initiatives, climate initiatives, whatever you want to call it, initiatives, and we've reached this state where we are truly a sustainable nation, and we've reduced a whole lot of these gases and all this other stuff that folks argue about. Is that reachable in your lifetime?
I think it's a necessity. I think it will be required to be reached within my lifetime, within our lifetimes. I think the next big debacle we have to face as society is going to be climate change. And mm-hmm. a lot of the businesses that put out net zero policies or decreasing our emissions by so much percentage by this amount of time, I think those are very positive pushes that start at the policy level and then work their way down. It's good to have those leaders talking about that. It will come about in our lifetime as a necessity.
When you think back to when you were little, growing up down there in South Georgia, watching your dad do his work and your mom, did you imagine you would have taken that same route even at that early of an age?
Hindsight makes it very apparent. It makes sense how I got here doing what I'm doing now.
And how excited are you for this graduation, your second degree, Clayton State University, bachelor's degree in chemistry?
I'm super excited about it. I'm very excited. My first degree, it was it was, as a professor put it, it was for funsies. I really enjoyed it. This one was equally fun, but also very practical.
Funsies?
For funsies, yep.
What professor told you that at Georgia State?
You have to say their name. I've been in school for a while. His name is Dr. Solomon. He taught me linear algebra back in 2010.
Funzy. Well, Andre, best of luck to you. Congratulations. Best of luck to you and your family. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for kicking off this year's Closer Looks annual graduate profile series. I really appreciate it. Andre LeWitt, a chemistry student from Clayton State University. Thank you so much, Andre. I really appreciate it. Andre, I got to tell you, you are the most laid. I thought I was laid back and cool. Brother, you are like the most laid back and cool person I've ever interviewed on this show. And I love it.
Thank you so much, Rose. I've been listening to your show for a long time. This has been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much.
All right, I appreciate it. Best of luck to you.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look. Coming up on tomorrow's program, a partnership between a real estate investment management company and a national hunger nonprofit. They're coming together to launch a food rescue and hunger relief program. And we'll meet an Emory University graduate who already had an established career in pediatric research and as an associate professor. But he's giving that all up to become a civil rights lawyer. That's on tomorrow's program. And if you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as in our podcast. Subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now plugged in, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.